welcome to the Icon Bar Podcast 4.
Whoa, hang on a minute, Phil. Who's this bird Ivy?
Who?
Ivy. Her name's all over my script. Podcast Ivy, there on the top. Are you trying to replace me or something?
No, it's our fourth podcast. Ivy is four.
Oh, well then, mate, she's far too young to be listening to this. I said fuck last time, and that sounds almost exactly like fuck.
Whoa! Read it again, Rich. Podcast 4. Ivy is Roman.
It doesn't sound like a very Italian name.
Forget it. Ivy's just a number.
Phil, that's a terrible thing to say. We are not a number, we are free men.
That's what you think.
Oh, hey there, Virtual Vige. What are you doing here with your long blonde hair, your knee-length leather boots, and your figure-hugging red dress, upon which is embroidered the name Ivy?
I'm from the agency. I'm here to introduce the news.
Well, go on then.
And now the news.
Okay, let's start with some software news then. Word on the street is that Andy Poole's finally finished his search app. Pooley!
Hi, Rich, how are you?
Yeah, mate, I'm good, thanks. Now, I hear you've released some software.
Yes, I have. I released Searchy last week.
Searchy, eh? What's that do then?
It's a small program that places a small window on the bottom of the screen in the OS, or in the future version, it would be anywhere on the screen. And it'll actually search the web with your favourite search engine.
Oh, I see. So a bit like Google Search on certain other OSs. So how long have you been working on that, then?
I started with a firm called Google a couple of years back, when I was in my first year at uni. I was bored on that. I liked the look of the toolbar that they had out for Internet Explorer. I decided I quite liked something like the SOS. Now, I know that you can't really embed things into many of the popular SOS browsers, so it has to be a standalone program. That was a very simple program, and then released it a couple of days later. I had about 20 to 30 emails of people saying how much they liked it and could have this, and this in it. So I released a few more updates. After a while, I decided it would be a cool idea to have other search engines as well. So I decided to change the name to Searchy and release it, a version that could let have multiple search engines. Unfortunately, I never actually got around to it for a very long time, about 3 years. Last week, I came back from university after a year out. I planned to write Searchy. It's quite the reason, actually, because I wrote Searchy while I had no internet connection, in the same way that I did when I wrote Google, actually, a few years back.
Yeah, you like making things difficult for yourself, don't you, mate? So what else are you working on now?
Currently, I'm mainly only working on Searchy and my university at the moment. There's a project that I've got on, which is a website content management system. I've not got a lot to say about that at the moment, because my university projects have sort of taken precedence over that.
Okay, well, I know you manage your own website with that, so here's hoping we get to see that one day, too.
Cheers, Rich. Bye.
Okay, mate, see ya. So remember, folks, if in the future you release software just prior to a podcast, I will hunt you down. Don't be afraid to get in touch. Now might be a good time for the software news, Phil.
Okay, then. Well, we've got Compose, which is a new visual programming tool written by David Llewellyn Jones, or the Flying Pig, as he's known, which looks a pretty cool way of just drag-and-drop program elements together, join them up with arrows, and there you go. You've got a fully functioning program. James Peacock has released version 007 of Avalanche, a RISC-OSS VNC client. I'm actually using it now to connect to my Mac, and it works pretty well. A demo version of RISC-CAD Pro version 10 has been released, and you can download that from the RISC-CAD website. RISC-CAD 10 will be officially released at the Southeast Show on the 22nd of October, and is written by David Buck.
Buck? Well, hey, that sounds almost exactly like...
Yeah, okay, Rich. Do some hardware news or something.
Bloody sportsport. Anyway, Advantage 6 Limited, those lovely people we interviewed last podcast, opened up the A9 beta scheme to advanced tome users. You know, 82% of our readers claim advanced status, which is fair enough, I suppose. You have to be advanced enough to at least set up a network stack and web browser, which isn't as easy on RISC-OSS as it used to be.
That or they're advanced enough to rig the poll. Well, number four. In the iCreate magazine list of podcasts, that is. Which means we're officially better than The Simpsons. It's in print and everything.
Which is kind of odd, considering that it's a Mac magazine. I guess we have David Bradford, who you might know better as the bloke from ProAction, to thank for that. Shall we give him a call?
Hello, this is David. If you want to, leave a message after the tone and I'll get back to you. If you don't, then fair enough. Bye.
Ooh, maybe we could have given him a little bit more warning.
So perhaps we should talk about Max for a while, just in case anyone who read that issue is listening.
Yeah, well, it does give you an excuse to natter on about your shiny new Mac Mini again, Phil.
It's not shiny now, it's a bit dusty.
Phil, we're recording.
Oh. Anyway, macOS is subjectively prettier and comes with excellent software as standard, like GarageBand and iMovie. But RiskOS has some great software too. There still isn't anything as good as Draw on any platform, really.
Because Draw is more useful than iPhoto or GarageBand?
Well, Draw and Stronghead alone keep me using RiskOS. Mind you, it's no good having great applications if the user interface sucks. So it's strange how at home I felt using the macOS for the first time.
Oh yeah? Example.
Well, you install software on the Mac in a very similar way to RiskOS. You download a zip file or disk image, open it, and drag the application to your hard drive, usually the apps folder.
Well, I guess that does sound kind of familiar.
Macs even use application directories, but they're called bundles in Mac speak.
Ah, well, there you go, you see. Superficially similar, but completely different under the hood.
So you don't want me to mention that they've copied the RiskOS icon bar too, then?
You what?
Yeah, the dock. When you run an application, its icon appears at the bottom of the screen, just like on RiskOS. Clicking it opens the window or document, and you can bring up a contextual menu on it too to perform some common actions or quit the program.
Bah, everybody nicked all this desktop malarkey from Xerox PARC in the 80s anyway.
The dock's good, but I still find the RiskOS method more tidy and logical. The dock also holds icons to launch applications in iconized windows, whereas RiskOS uses the pinboard for that.
Yeah, RiskOS might not be the most powerful OS or the prettiest or anything like that, but when it comes to just getting the job done for programming or graphics or whatever, RiskOS is the one I keep coming back to.
Yeah, no, good.
Well, that seems like a good place to end this fair and impartial comparison.
Yeah. And now for the interview. This time we're talking to Chris Basley, best known for his work on Starfighter 3000. So, how did you get into RiskOS then, Chris?
Well, like most people, it was because they had Acorn machines at school, most of which were BBCs. But there were one or two Archimedes, which I thought were just the bee's knees. Not because I had any great interest in RiskOS as a desktop operating system, it was because they ran shocks away. And at the time, I was very much into Biggles, having read all those books, you know, First World War, Fighter Pilots, Adventures, Excitement, and all that stuff. And at the time, it was the most amazing flight simulator I'd ever seen. In fact, I couldn't really conceive how the graphics could be better, although with hindsight, that's slightly ridiculous. That's how I used to spend my lunch times. But as for programming RiskOS, that came from a totally different route. It was because my older brother, Nicholas, used to collect old computers. We would go around car boot sales basically picking them up, and he had a very wide taste. He would buy almost any old computer he could get, like we'd be carting Commodore PETs and TRS-80s and other weird beasts home on the back of his bike. I was much more interested in the Acorn Electron that he bought because he pointed out that it ran the same variety of BASIC as the machines at school. So that's really how I got into programming. But I didn't get a RiskOS machine of my own until many, many years later when I could actually afford it. I traded in my Sega Master System because I realised that I could play Lemmings on an Archimedes and could probably do a lot more on other interesting things as well.
So what was the first Archimedes you got then?
It was a BBC A3000, which was, well, as far as I was concerned, it was just the latest in a long line of BBCs because I've always been a big fan of BBCs, perhaps even more so than Acorn computers in general. We were given a silly assignment in class at school. This was in RE. We had to invent our own religion. And, of course, the idea was to draw parallels between things like, you know, people supporting football clubs and religion, things like that. But my classmate and I invented this religion called BBCism. It was very tongue-in-cheek, you know. We had to name our religious text, which, of course, was the user guide and, you know, what pilgrimages you could undertake, like to Cambridge and things like that.
I bet there's quite a lot of people who were quite willing to follow that religion. I think I would anyway.
It was all pretty silly.
So let's talk a bit about the development then of Starfighter. How did you get involved in doing that then?
It all started when Richard Wilson wrote an application called NoDisk, the point of which was to remove the encryption code, which is strong arm incompatible. And at the time there was quite a row, I seem to remember, between him and the publishers because they were saying quite rightly that this program could be used to infringe copyright. But having got hold of that, I suddenly realised I could get inside Star Trek 3000, which is what I started doing. And I got very overexcited and posted a thing to Usenet, Compsys Acorn Games, which was from 1999, January the 26th. And that's really what started it all off. I got a few replies to that, and some of them said, yes, go ahead, you can hack the game and make it so much better. And most of them were rightly very sceptical, because it was an almost impossible task that I'd set myself. I remember hacking that in my first year of university. Basically, I spent about a year hacking it, and I did get quite a long way. I broke the copy protection with the assistance of NoDisk, but there was a lot more to it than that. I mean, a lot of the files in the original game are deliberately named to be misleading, and it's really quite convoluted. The eureka moment really came when I realized that the run file, which has big warning notices all over it not to edit it actually contains commands that are invisible called space and space space and space space space. Obviously you can't see what on earth is going on.
Is the work that you've done on Starfighter purely reverse engineered then, sort of tucking into the existing code? Did you get the source or...?
I basically benefited a lot from the assistance of Nathan Atkinson, who used to be the frontman for Visions of the Impossible, as a lot of people probably remember. And he had obtained the source code for Starfighter from Andrew Hutchings. And I spent the rest of 2000 until the end of 2000 trying to implement some of the supposedly wonderful ideas I'd had for improving Starfighter. And actually got quite a long way with things like variable resolution and support for 24-bit colour and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that work has ever come to light because ISP Product contacted me towards the end of 2000 and said, look, we really like this patch you've made, which this was SF patch, which was to make it compatible with Riscos 4 and StrongArm. And they said we'd like to reissue the game commercially. So thereafter, all my efforts were concentrated on, you know, making something at work as opposed to, you know, fiddling around with the innards of the game. There were some bugs that I thought would be an easy fix, and they turned out to be far more complicated because seemingly arbitrary restrictions were in there for a very good reason. And in the case of the pop-up distance, which is a criticism which has been levelled at Starfighter 3000 quite rightly, because if you turn the detail level down, you do literally get hills sprouting up off the ground in front of you. And, you know, if you're travelling several thousand miles an hour towards it and it suddenly appears in front of you, you're a bit buggered.
Yeah. I've fallen foul of that a few times, I think.
Okay, so I did something about that, though not as much as I had hoped, because a lot of these things I tried to implement, I found, you know, I would think, why have they done that? That's really pointless. And then if you try and change parameters within the game code, you'll find out why they did those things.
So what grand plans for it did you have?
On RISC-PC, the game sound wasn't nearly as good as it was on the Archimedes, which was quite a retrograde step. And the problem was with the pitch of the engine noise, because it's supposed to make this roar rising to a shriek as you go fast. And it's weird. This is one of the things that people really like about the game, almost more than anything else, because I've had email from people saying, please, can we have individual volume controls for the different effects? Because I really like the noise of the engine. I don't like any of the rest of it. But re-enabling it, as I discovered, caused completely arbitrary crashes where the whole machine would hang up. And it wasn't until I completely rewrote the sound module to support 16-bit sound and shared sound and lots of other things that I actually cured that problem.
I was going to say, I've never actually played it on a RISC PC. I've only played it on a A3010, lowest resolution graphics and everything.
Yeah, I have a quote here from Tony Houghton, which I think probably it was on my mind and probably goading me when I was hacking the game. If you think hacking all those new features into the existing Acorn version without source is remotely possible, let alone easier than porting from another version source, I wouldn't have thought you have enough experience to do either. At the time, I was very annoyed about, but with hindsight, he was absolutely right. And yeah, I have a lot of respect for Tony Houghton. He's helped me out in other ways, like he released source code for some of his C applications, and a lot of my C applications have been quite heavily based on his style of programming. So it's a quote that struck me as amusing in retrospect.
Are there a lot of clever tricks and things that you can sort of see in the source code? Sort of bits where you'd look at it and you think, what on earth is that doing?
A lot of it's very hard to understand when you look at it because it's not terribly well commented, especially Andrew Hutchings' bits. Because he was obviously some very clever guy, I don't know, probably genius by my standards, but he would write these reams and reams of ARM code to do complicated trigonometric transformations and things with hardly any comments at all. So certainly not readable by most people's standards, I think. Interestingly enough, because the game was developed by two people, and they were obviously working apart, the game used to use a runtime linking system, which was yet another additional complication to my work with it, really, none of which still exists. I felt a bit like a vandal when I was taking out that bit, but it's just totally unnecessary complication.
What's your favourite level on Starfighter, then? What's your favourite mission?
I was thinking about this, and it's a tricky question. I mean, on one level, I would have expected me to be completely sick of the game because I spent so long testing it and looking for bugs. In fact, to the extent I would start seeing bugs that probably no one else has ever noticed, like a pixel wrong here or, you know, a line not quite right there. My favourite level is the one with the satellite surrounding the big starship that looks like the Starship Enterprise. This is in cyberspace with a ceiling and a floor and lots of pillars. And the reason it's my favourite one is that that was where I tracked down the bug which causes you to crash into the satellite while firing madly at them because your shots are going straight through. But I was playing the game on that level one day, and I was able to replicate it. And I thought, this is amazing. And I replicated it again and again. And the reason I was able to replicate it was that all these satellites are stationary, and they're stationary around a very large ship. And the bug only manifests when there are lots of ships at the same latitude. And of course, the only thing that makes it reproducible is the fact that the satellites are stationary. So that's my bizarre reason for liking that level better.
I think I remember those levels being incredibly difficult. I just kept crashing into like the ceiling or the floor all the time.
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with the AI-controlled ships crashing into the floor and ceiling and pillars and things. And I spent weeks trying to make them less stupid, which is quite hard to do. They don't have much collision avoidance, and the collision avoidance they do have is all based around which way am I facing? Is there anything in that direction? And, of course, there's a lot of other pseudo-physics in Star Trek 3000, which causes ships to fly sideways, and obviously if they're turning as well, then that form of collision detection is nigh on useless because they won't see the pillar coming until it's bang in front of their nose, by which time it's too late.
The upside-down docking, what's the trick to that then?
There's a page on my website called So You Think You're Good, if somebody's completed the game, or even if somebody's just picked up the game to sort of demonstrate what sort of silly stunts you can do. Anyway, my favourite is the upside-down docking, which I was not convinced was even possible. I was very excited the first time I managed to do it.
Is it just practice and practice, or...?
At college, I used to watch people struggle for 5 or 10 minutes trying to dock with the mothership, and every time they lined themselves up, it would turn. It just drove them completely mad. But that is why the first level of the game is docking. You don't really have to do anything else. It's just purely docking, because if you can't dock, then you're not going to be able to dock on the 10th level or the 20th level when you're trying to do it under fire from the ground and attacking ships and things like that. But, you know, given that most people can't dock at all when they first pick up the game, I think upside-down docking is just the ultimate silliness.
I can't even dock in Elite. I always have to cheat and use a file with the docking computer on.
Oh, dear. Yeah, docking's a perennial problem in computer games. Well, it reminds me, I think there's a line in the original Elite manual saying something about how you need to have your frontal lobes reversed in order to use the rear laser. Or maybe I read that somewhere on the internet. But I think it's a similar sort of thing. You need your frontal lobes reversed in order to dock upside down, I guess, because the mouse operates completely opposite direction you expect it to. But once you arrive in the docking bay, the fed end matter tractor beam bins you around so that you're the right way up, fortunately, otherwise you crash horribly. This is why I was intrigued partly. I wasn't sure exactly what would happen if you were able to achieve it, but the game is robust enough to tolerate it.
So what about the versions of Starfighter for other platforms then? Do you know much of those?
I don't really know much about them. Well, I know the bare bones, which is that the PC version was ported by Christmas. And I've actually played it, and it's quite playable, and it has some cool features which aren't in the Acorn version, and arguably better graphics as well. The only other version I know that FedNet worked on themselves was the 3DO version, and in fact a port of that to Risk OS with Mootage. And I've seen screenshots of it, but the project seems to have gone into some sort of hibernation.
I've never heard of anything about that happening before.
When I heard about it, I was in two minds as to whether I should continue working on the ARM code version, because obviously it would be a bit futile if this amazing new version came out of the port back to Risk OS from the 3DO version. But seemingly nothing ever came of it.
I still think the Risk OS version is the classic, really.
Yeah, I think so, which is why I've spent so much time on it. An insane amount of time, I think, by anyone's standards.
I don't actually know much of the history of those two or how they got together to do that. Did both of them do Stunt Racer as well?
Yeah, I think Stunt Racer was also by the same guys, Tim Parry and Andrew Hutchings. Prior to that, I don't know of anything by Tim Parry, but Andrew Hutchings has written Shocks Away, which I'm sure most people have heard of.
You've never been able to get in touch with them, then?
I don't know what happened to FedNet. I don't think anyone does. You can search on the internet for Andrew Hutchings and Tim Parry, but there's nothing contemporary, I suppose, in the way it's none of our business.
Looking on your Starfighter website, the version history and the news that you've got goes back years now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was going through my hard disk trying to find the earliest Starfighter-related hackery or other work that I'd done. And I was quite astonished. I started writing a level editor in January 1998. And I've only just released the first version of a Starfighter level editor, so it's 7 years? Yeah, it doesn't help in the case of the level editor. I basically started writing it three times over because I'm also a perfectionist, and I get to a certain point and I think, no, I could do this much better in a different language. Like, the original version was written in BASIC, and then I rewrote it in C. And then I rewrote it using the toolbox. And then the toolbox version went through at least 5 different revisions of user interface. I mean, you can see some of the different iterations on the Starfighter website. But I think I finally arrived at a version I'm happy with, which is why I released it.
You've released the upgrade now, which is freely available for people to download. What was your motivation for doing that then?
Okay, well, my motivation was that it had been nagging at the back of my mind for some time that the last release I'd done for 26-bit machines was version 2.04, which had at least one heinous bug in, which was my own fault. The heinous bug being the fact that when rotating space stations launch ships, the ship would be smashed by the rotation of the space station before they really cleared the hangar, which I thought might be affecting playability. I mean, there are a whole slew of other bugs fixed between that version and the 32-bit compatible versions. And, you know, there's this ongoing argument in the RISC-OSS market, I don't know how much it affects other markets, about whether or not bug fixes should be free. And personally, I feel they should. So that was nagging at the back of my mind, and also the fact that the game had just passed its 10-year anniversary, and I thought it was probably time to cut people a bit of slack. And also, partly I have to say, it's down to APDL, because if I didn't have their permission, then I wouldn't have done it. So at least half the credit goes to them.
Yeah, excellent.
Perhaps I should say, it's Starfighter, one word, .acornarcade, one word again, .com or .co.uk.
So long as they've got the existing levels already, because they've bought a copy in the past, the floppy or CD versions.
The fact is, you do need to buy the game. You can't simply go to the website and download it, because most of the level data is missing. It's just possible that somebody doesn't have it yet and still wants to buy it, in which case it's available from APDL. The last time I checked, the price was £19.90. That's on a compilation CD with 3 other games. The other games are Air Supremacy, Elite, and Sunburst. And unfortunately, they aren't 32-bit compatible, which caused some controversy, I think, at the time it was 32-bit compatible. Upgrade was released, because people were saying, you know, why should we pay for 4 games and then only get 1? So I don't know what the state of affairs with that will be in the future.
Well, thanks for taking up your Sunday afternoon to do the call.
Okay, cheers. Bye.
Okay, time for some feedback.
That's a terrible gag, but it has to be done.
Yeah, let's just get on with it, shall we?
Okay, letters time. A letter has flooded in from Linotype in Germany. It's a cease and desist letter.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be that guy opening his mail one morning to find a €25,000 demand waiting for him. Oh, wait.
Well, why don't we call him and do a quick interview?
Yeah, sure. You got his number to hand.
Check it out!
Today, we're interviewing Richard Goodwin about the closing of the font site that the Icon Bar hosted.
Yeah, hi there, Phil.
Hi, Rich. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us.
Oh, yeah, sure. No problem. I was in the neighbourhood anyway.
So what happened to the font site?
Well, I opened my mail one morning and found a €25,000 demand waiting for me.
Scary.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
Well, I tried to contact Harry Decker to get him to remove the offending fonts, De Ruz, Frustia, Helvetica, Palatino and Times. Unfortunately, Harry was apparently an Argonet customer, so the mail redirect to his account didn't work, and as the site hadn't been updated since about April 2003, I decided I had no other recourse than to close the site.
Did that satisfy them?
Well, I mean, I hope so. I emailed them back and asked them to confirm that they're happy, and they said yes, for now, whatever that means.
So, do you think they'll still want to find Harry?
I'm not sure. I mean, I did a bit of digging myself, and according to Google, he appears to have moved to America and become a baseball star in the 1880s. Or he's a fictional detective in a short-lived CBS television show?
So it's unlikely he'll be found.
Would you come forward with a $25,000 debt hanging over you?
I suppose not. So what about the future?
Well, I would like to thank all the people who offered to host the site, but without knowing what else is in there, I think we'll be leaving ourselves open to a world of pain.
At least until someone writes a BitTorrent client for RISC-OSS.
You said that, mate, not me.
So, that was Richard Goodwin, the webmaster who...
Actually, Phil, I prefer Hostmaster, so it doesn't like I actually owned that particular site. Or Benevolent Dictator, perhaps?
Rich Goodwin, the Icon Bar's Benevolent Dictator there, talking about the font site.
Check it out!
Well, he seemed like a nice fella, didn't he?
We put out an advanced warning that the podcast was going to be recorded, and asked for input from you lot.
And Phil was foolish enough to bet me 20p that no bugger would call in.
And was I right?
Well, yes and no. We did get one call.
Hi, my name's Sarah and NetSurf makes me horny.
Which may not have any content, but it's enough to make you lose the bet. Cough up.
Right then. Guess that's about it for the phone-in section then.
Yeah, guess so. Right then, folks, that's your lot. And don't forget, Risk Our Southeast Show, 22nd October, that's this Saturday. If you're listening before Saturday, if you're listening after the show, then it's... Oh, okay. It's at the Guildford College, anyway. Go to www.fillin.co.uk/SE show. Got all that? Good. Right, it's really done this time. Turning it off. Switching off now. Bye. No, you turn off. No, you turn off. No. Okay, bye.
One morning I was, I got the tin opener out of the drawer and started opening a can of worms until I realised, what was I doing?
You can be my secretary. That means you have to get an outfit as well. Now would be a good time to ring off, I guess.
Did that satisfy them? Freudian slip. That sounds incredibly unnatural. It's not me. What? I think we have gone mad now.
Yeah,
let's
just save that out.
Yeah, I blame that I'm reading Moss's comments on the playpen at the same time. It's just something about what he touches when he's using a computer.
I'm out of here. Peace.
Nah, go on, you hang up.